November 5th, 1981, talking to Chuck Dart in Manly Hot Springs. This is a follow-up to the manuscript and a few additions. This is about the rescue of Chris Fairfield.
Cliff Fairchild.
What did I say?
Fairfield. Chris Fairfield. This was. One guy told me I made a mistake. He's a Fort Yukon bootlegger, is who he was.
You don't want that.
What, are we on?
Yes.
Oh. Okay. I'm not just sure of when this happened, but it was, I believe, in June, probably late June of 1952. We were living on Wolf Run, which is near the end of Phillips Field and across the slough from the end of Phillips Field. And it was on a Saturday evening after work. We had had supper, and I was sitting on the floor reading the paper. And because we lived there for a while, there were lots of airplanes coming and going, and never paid attention to them. But I became aware of this one when I heard a sudden change in the engine sound, and very soon I heard a crash, and I ran outside and could see nothing until the airplane burst into flames. It was about 200 feet away in some brush and very close to some tall spruce trees. And I ran over there, and I could see the airplane was at right angles to its normal line of flight, and it was upside down in a little swale at the base of some large white spruce. And as I got close to the airplane, maybe about 30 feet, all I could see in the cockpit was potatoes. A sack of potatoes had broken open, and that's all you could see in through the glass of the cockpit. And as I got about 25 or 30 feet from the airplane, there was some kind of a gas line ruptured, and a stream of gasoline, flaming gasoline, engulfed my legs like a flamethrower. And my father had burned to death, and the thought that went through my head was, I'm going to die like Dad. But there wasn't any gasoline to sustain the fire, and it was just a flash, and it was gone. And there was an 18-year-old boy that was camping on our ground with his family, and I didn't know it at the time, but he was behind me, and he yelled, "Look out, Chuck!" And then the pilot was aware that there were people nearby, and he yelled, "I'm over here." And from in the airplane, and we went around on the other side of the airplane, and we could see his head hanging down. He was inverted, still strapped in his seat, and another sack of potatoes had taken a small triangular window out when a crash occurred. So there was that opening, and I reached into that and tried to pull him through. He said, wait a minute. And while he was loosening his seatbelt and getting himself in position, I was trying to pull out the fragments of glass that was stuck in the channel of the window. And John Workman was the boy's name, was stamping out a little fire that was burning in some moss. And I thought at the time, you know, this ridiculous to be doing that. Here's the airplane is burning and he's stamping out this little fire in the moss. But it made as much sense as me trying to pull that glass out of the frame, which was in there really tight. But anyway, Cliff Fairchild got his arms and head through that opening, and we reached in and grabbed him under the armpit, each of us on one side, and pulled hard. And he was pushing too with his feet, I'm sure. And we got him started through, and then the glass in that frame started to bite into his back. But there was, I mean, they were only superficial cuts, and it was, I mean, there was no choice, you know. It wasn't something that there was any doubt about what we would do. And we pulled him on through, and we got him out of there, and about 10 or 15 feet from the airplane, he wanted to sit down and rest. But we didn't want him to, and it was then that I thought to ask if there was anybody else in the airplane, and there wasn't. But it never occurred to me before that time to wonder if there was any other passenger in there. But happily, there wasn't. There would have been no chance for another person. Anyway, we just got him out of there when the fire really took off, and the spruce trees went whoosh too, like they do with when they get hot enough, and just went up in a fast fire. And we got them to the road, which was, I would say, less than 100 feet from Wolf Run. And the crash had been seen from Bochner's Hangar. And they called KFAR, why, I don't know. And it was put on the air. They also called the Alaska Railroad because they had a fire department, and they responded. And the Ladfield Fire Department responded too, but they got their directions mixed up, and they went out Farmers Loop Road. It was a Saturday evening. And I suppose people didn't have that much exciting things to do, so they followed the fire trucks. And University Avenue then was just a dirt road, gravel road. Very dry. My God, the column of dust was something to see on that road. And quite a few people came. But anyway, Fairchild only suffered rather minor burns on the back of his ankles, and I think he was in the hospital maybe 2 or 3 days and released.
So what did you think about that in retrospect?
I've never talked to him.
Hmm.
His wife came that evening and thanked us profusely.
She was in Fairbanks.
Yeah, right.
Where was the dog?
Fort Yukon, right, and he was hauling freight, and what had happened was there was a change in the variable pitch propeller. What caused the change, I don't know, whether it was pilot or mechanical, I've been told it's wasn't a mechanical problem, but I'm not competent to judge that to start to think, and don't know anything about it. But he was probably overloaded, and then with the change in the pitch of the prop, he was under, the plane wasn't just pulling like it should have been, and he didn't clear the trees.
Well, after it was all taken care of, what did you think? I mean, did you think much about how you yourself had been in danger?
Not really. As a matter of fact, it wasn't until quite a while afterwards that I began to shake a little. I did have a recurring nightmare for some time after that about an airplane crash across a valley that would crash and burn, and I was never able to get there. And it was, in the dream, it was obvious right from the start that I would never be able to make it all the way across to do any good. And why I dreamed that, I don't know how many times, but a number of times for several months. Sure. I was aware that it was a hazardous situation, but I mean there wasn't really a choice, you know. It wasn't something that you could weigh the actions that you were going to take or not take. It just, I'm sure it was anybody would have done the same thing, just automatic. Right, right. I mean, you can't let a guy burn to death in front of you when there's possibility of doing something.
Well, how, you mentioned that you thought about your father. How was it that he burned?
It was a gasoline explosion. He was starting a fire with what was sold to him as kerosene, but was in fact a mixture of kerosene and gasoline, which he should not have been doing. And there was a trial about it, and nothing would have come of this, but there was another explosion in the neighborhood in the small town in northern Minnesota of the same type, involving the same kerosene, but it was in a little summer kerosene cook stove that the explosion occurred. So they took, they made a laboratory analysis of the product, and it turned out that it was not kerosene, that it was a mixture of kerosene and gasoline, and which had been caused by the delivery man to that little rural store pumping gas into the kerosene container. And there was a settlement, but the court also ruled that there was contributory negligence on my father's part. So I mean, I've forgotten what the amount was, maybe $6,000 or $7,000, which it was calculated according to the life expectancy and all to him. He was 63 at the time, so. Actually, I think, as I recall now, it was settled out of court. It went once to the Minnesota Supreme Court, and then they returned it to the lower court, and then the lawyers got together and settled it before it went to trial the second time. But I was up here and I wasn't that closely involved with it. I went to the original trial at the request of my mother. But when the judge gave a directed verdict and didn't let it go to the jury, that was enough for me, but the lawyers persisted in their appeal and they turned it around.
Well, thought that you were going to go the same way as your father must have been. I shook you up a little bit.
Well, actually, it was one of those things that happened so suddenly, you know, and it was a thought that flashed through my mind, but then it was over with too, and certainly the situation didn't leave me to dwell on it at the time.
Well, how did the rest of your family react to all this? Were they around?
Well, Gladys, actually, you couldn't see unless you got pretty close because of that brush that's in there. You know, you could see the fire. I'm sure you could see flames through there, but you, a person wouldn't be able to see any action going on. And I really don't know. Of course, Diane was a small baby. Not a small baby, she was a year old.
Well, what effect did that have later on in, say, the next several years? The effect of dealing with that accident? Was there any, did it change, like not fly small planes or?
No, that. It didn't have any effect on me as far as a desire to fly or impeding me from flying. I hadn't flown that much. Well, I guess I had, but it wasn't significant in that way. The only thing that happened that I know of was the FAA or CAA, whoever it was that is in authority, changed the takeoff pattern for planes leaving Phelps Field, which is still in effect, unless the wind from the west is, 10 or 15 miles, they have to take off to the east instead of to the west to avoid the trees there on Irene's place.
Well, from what Glass was saying the other night, it seemed like it had quite an impact on her.
Is that right? Well, I didn't hear that. You and she were having a different conversation.
She said it was a significant event in the family.
Oh, I'm sure she felt proud that I was involved in this heroic rescue.
Was it carried in the papers?
Yeah, it was. It was in the News Miner and also in Jessen's Weekly.
Now all these people that came down University Avenue following the fire department, this crowd around the place there at Wolf Run, what happened to that bunch of people?
Oh, quite a few of them went over to the airplane to look at it, you know, and some of them picked up stuff to remove that went through there. And there was a FAA man that came around a day or two later to get eyewitness accounts. And he talked to me and Bert Balvin. I don't remember where John Workman was at that time. He may have talked to him at a separate time.
So how was it to be a hero?
Kind of embarrassing. But there were some people that talked to me about how proud I should be, or I don't know if that's just what they said, but one teacher at the university said that I should be nominated for some kind of medal. which was, I mean, to me, it wasn't that big a thing. I mean, it wasn't heroic in terms of planning something where you were deliberately risking your neck or extending your limits. It was just something that happened. It isn't something that I would have chosen to do. It was just a position that I was thrust into.
So if you're in the same situation, you'd probably do exactly the same thing.
Well, presumably, but there's really no way to know how you're going to react. Although I have been in a couple of emergency situations, no big thing, but I'm able to function without any problem. And I know that there are some people that just kind of freeze up and don't function. I mean,
I'm sure it must have been reassuring to Gladys too, to know that when something happens, you count on you, that your reflexes are to help out, save the day.
Yeah. Well.
Okay. Sounds like good. Is there anything else that?
If you're talking, you should talk into the microphone.
I'm asking you. I'm not talking to this. I'm asking, is there anything else we would... I think mainly captions for photographs later.
Yeah.
Okay, that's it.